Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Legendary guitarist and songwriter Tommy Bolin's teaser album was recorded at the Record Plant in Los Angeles, California in 1975, with additional recording at Electric Lady Studios in New York and Trident Studios in London. It was mixed at Trident Studios in London by Dennis McKay. Production credits went to Tommy Bolin and Lee Kiefer, except for People People and Marching Powder, which were produced by Dennis McKay. Those two tracks were done late to fill out the album out better and required Tommy and Dennis to travel back to Electric Lady to record the material. McKay would go on to co-produce Private Eyes with Tommy in 1976. Private Eyes, Tommy Bolin, released in 76. After recording finished at Cherokee, the album was mixed at Trident Studios in London. McKay demonstrated great skill in editing and mixing the material, turning 7 days of rapid recording by an unrehearsed band into an iconic album. Dennis McKay would go on to engineer or produce a remarkable range of artists, including Tommy Bolin, Jeff Beck, Judas Priest, Return to Forever, Billy Cobham, Brand X, Gong, Pat Travers, Al Dimeola, David Bowie, Mick Ronson, Jack Bruce, Whitney Houston, and the list goes on and on. McKay won a Grammy Award in 2010 for the Stanley Clark Band Best Contemporary Jazz Album. Please welcome Grammy Award-winning producer, engineer, Dennis McKay to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Dennis.
Hello. How are you, Ray?
Pretty good, man. I'm running out of paper from all your accolades there.
Wait, you didn't mention them all.
I know I didn't.
I know. It's pretty remarkable, actually. It's been great, absolutely great, working with all these great artists. You know, I'm very lucky, very, very lucky.
Have you written a book or anything on the art of producing and engineering? If not,
no. I know people tell me to do that because I've been doing it for so long. So that's, you know, a possible thing that I will get involved with, you know. So I'm looking forward to doing that.
Yeah, a lot of people would definitely learn a lot from that. I know for a fact. One of your favorite studios, and probably one of the most legendary studios, was Trident.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I started at Trident as a gopher, a T-boy.
Really?
And I was 16 years old when I started.
Huh.
And I was there for like 8 years. But we had some great people working at Trident. You know, we had like Ken Scott, who ended up doing a lot of the Bowie albums, Hunky Dory, Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane. Then he did All Things Must Pass, you know, amongst many great artists, Lou Reed.
Yep.
Take a Walk on the Wild Side. I mean, it was just incredible. Supertramp. And then there was another engineer, Roy Thomas Baker, RTB, who ended up producing Queen.
Yep.
Who he actually found the band somewhere in London. And he asked me, he said, Dennis, listen, I know you know, you're just getting out of being a gopher. He said, but would you like to record some demos with this band that I found? You know, and I went, absolutely. So that night, Queen came in. You know, and I'm looking around the studio, never been in the studio before. So I recorded some demos and put it on a cassette, if everybody can remember what a cassette is.
I do, of course.
What's he talking about? Anyway, gave it back to Roy, and he ended up producing, I think he did like 4 or 5 albums, and up to date, I think they've sold like 200 million albums.
Now, was that your first, kind of producing, or
it was just purely just miking up. I wasn't really an engineer. I was right. I mic'd up the drums and the keyboard, and they just played some demos, you know, some tracks, and then I put it just straight to a cassette and then gave it to Roy.
You know, it's amazing how many bands did record on a cassette, you
right,
know,
absolutely.
In the beginning. And
yeah, definitely. I mean, it was just, you know, we had some great artists, though, at Tribe. Right. I mean, it was just every other, like, week or 2 weeks, it would be, like, Carly Simon's You're So Vain, mm-hmm. you know, which was a great album, you know. And then we had people like The Who. I mean, it was amazing. We did a lot of the White album there.
That's right.
You know, and it was just incredible. I mean, Harry Nilsson Smilsson, yep. Son of Smilsson. Then we did, I think Ken Scott recorded John McLaughlin there. In a, mm-hmm. I forget the album title, so many years ago, but it was like, we did some fusion albums there, and with a lot of rock albums. I mean, it was just a great time, great time.
Well, Hey Jude was recorded there.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And a lot of the Apple artists, you know, one of my favorite bands was always Badfinger. You know,
it's Badfinger, yeah.
Shame what happened to them. And
George Harrison wrote a lot of their hits.
Exactly. And Mary Hopkin, I think, recorded
Mary
there.
Mary Hopkin. Those were the days. Those were the days, yep. My friend. I thought they would never end.
That's a great song.
Yeah. And you know who she married?
No, I don't.
Tony Visconti.
I did not know that.
Yeah, he was. They got married, and Tony Visconti ended up producing like T-Rex at Trident.
Right.
And then he ended up doing Bowie's last album.
Really?
Before he passed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so he was a great producer.
Mary Hopkin became a recluse, you know? She didn't do a whole lot. And
I know. Actually, after that track, mm-hmm. I mean, there wasn't very much left. I mean, it was weird. She just kind of disappeared.
Yep.
You know? And it was sad because, you know, Paul McCartney wrote that track.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, it was, wasn't it Norman Sheffield that actually started the studio back in...
Yeah, Norman yep. Sheffield and Barry Sheffield.
And, right.
They were brothers, kind of scary individuals.
Why is that?
So they were, in the respect, it was Soho, you know, like, they were very kind of tough, you know, when I went for my interview,
uh-huh.
It was pretty amazing because I sat there, there was like 8 other T-boys going, you know, wanting the job.
Right.
So all of a sudden, you know, the receptionist says, Dennis, you can go upstairs now, they're waiting for you. And I said, who's waiting for me? Barry Sheffield and Norman Sheffield. I went, oh, okay. You know, so I ended up going into the room and it was full of cigar smoke.
Right.
And Barry Sheffield says to me, he goes, right. He goes, listen, Dennis. He goes, how much do you get? And I had a part-time job in London.
Uh-huh.
And I was getting in those days like £14 a week.
Oh, wow.
Which is like in those days, $2 to a pound.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, and I thought dollars or pounds, it ended up being dollars. Anyway, they said to me, Dennis, we're going to give you £9 a week. And you have to clean out the bog holes. Right, and I said, clean out the what? The toilets. The poop holes. And I went, and then all of that, and what happened, Ray, was this. I'm sitting there, and I've actually got a comfortable job, you know, and I'm sitting there listening to them
right.
going at me. Don't you know, if anybody pukes in the studio, you've got to pick it up. You know, we don't have a cleaning crew. You're going to do everything.
Wow.
I went, but my mind was made up. I don't think I want this job. You know? So what happened was, in the back of my mind, I'm going, I can't, I'm living with my parents, and I can't go back home saying, Mom, you know, they cut my wage by half, you know, but I want the job. I was going, and I clean out the toilets and this and pick up puke when somebody throws up. What?
Yeah.
So anyway, so I made up my mind, I'm not doing it. But I gave them the impression. I went, Dennis, you're going to clean out the toilet. Absolutely, I'd love to do that.
Yes, sir.
And they go, and you've got to clean the studio, and you've got to do. And they just rub my nose. Yeah, absolutely. I kept saying, you got it. That's perfect. And then I left, and I went. Whew. A week later, they called me and said, Dennis, Barry Sheffield here. Listen, you got the job. Because you're the only person that agreed to everything.
How about that?
We have our own cleaning crew, by the way.
You said, thank God.
And I went, wow. You know, I'm like, oh, I go, what? And I got the job, and that's how I started.
That's incredible.
I used to listen to the Kinks, you know, and I used to love that band, yeah. And that's what started me. You know, I thought, how did they get things on vinyl?
Yeah.
And what, you know, how do they do that? And that's what could put my interest in going finding a studio.
Well, see, you started from ground zero. I mean,
yeah, absolutely, yeah. You know, and from that, the great thing is about Trident. This is an amazing thing, and I think people should do this in companies and everything.
Right.
What happened was this: the tape operator could fire the T-boy.
Right.
The engineer could fire the tape operator. So everybody worked together because you're too frightened. Either you might be fired. You know? So it's cohesive. Everybody did their best. And that's why, I mean, Trident wasn't a great sonic, you know, what a great studio. It was very basic, very plain.
Right.
But it was the engineers.
Yeah.
Ken Scott, Roy Thomas Baker, Robin Cable, David Henschild. In David Henschild, for instance, he engineered Yellow Brick Road.
Yeah.
That's you know? Right. Great sound, great engineering, and, you know, we did a lot of Elton John albums there, like three or four albums there at Trident.
Now, what I understand, too, they were the first in the UK to have Dolby noise reduction and
eight-track
reel-to-reel. Yeah.
And that was amazing, too. And the first studio to have 16-track.
16-track, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was kind of experimental, but it was, you know, it was amazing because the people that came there, we had a guy from America, was it Richard Perry?
Richard Perry, yeah.
Yeah, and he came there, and he did like one project there, but he liked it so much, then he brought Harry Nilsson there, Carly Simons, you know, No Secrets album we did there.
Yeah, you did Brand X there, too. Is that right?
Yeah, I did Unorthodox Behavior in Rock and Roll.
Yeah.
Between Morgan Studios and Trident. And that was great, too, because those two albums, I mean, even now, people still say, Dennis, great-sounding albums.
Yep.
Great-sounding albums. And it's like, well, what a compliment, you know?
Well, you know, an engineer is, to me, everything, you know? And
yeah.
A lot of the new artists today are, like, overproduced, you know? Sometimes they say it's good to leave in errors in the music because it makes, you know, and I agree with that. I mean, some of the best recordings to me were like in the 60s, on, you know, the old 45s are nice and clear. You know, they had that kind of echo effect in the background.
Right. Yeah.
They were great sounding, you know?
I know. I mean, you know, when the first digital track came out, which was, it was Yes, the band Yes, and the track was dun, 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 dun. Movie Set. Remember that track?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, what was that called? I forget what it was called.
Owner of a Lonely Heart.
Oh, Lonely Heart.
Right.
Right. That was the first digital recording, mix and mix. And when I heard that, and it was so great how that started.
It was cool.
It started off crackling like plain vinyl.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there's an edit, and then it goes digital, which, you know, at first, there was so much tape noise coming from like 24-track analog.
Yeah.
I could see it, you know, it's like, wow, this is, but there was something, everybody, when I work with a lot of people, the drummer always says to me, Dennis, about the drums, listen, I want that analog sound,
right.
You know?
Yep.
It's warm and it's wide. And I totally agreed with them because I'm more of like the sound has to come from the source, you know? And with digital, it comes from the digital side. It's so clean that it loses something in there.
Exactly.
I know I've grown up with it now, and I accept it, and everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But it did lose a lot.
Yeah.
And there's still, you know, some of the low end of analog is still not represented with digital yet, 100%. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
Uh-huh.
I don't understand how in the world you guys can control those boards, you know, with all the with all the slide dials. There's a million of them. There's a million of them.
Yeah, I know. You know, I just say to people, like, when they stand behind me and they go, you know how to operate all this? Yeah. But the thing was, you know, like I say to everybody, if you know one channel, you know 24 or 48 channels. They're all the same.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you've got the playback side, and then, you know, so it was kind of, but it was, you know, it looks impressive.
It does.
But you know, in those days, when I'd work exclusively with Ken Scott, yep. And I would have one side of the console and Ken would have the other.
Uh-huh.
And we're doing like Hunky Dory or right. Ziggy Stardust, whatever album it was.
Right.
We used to put it down because there was no digital, obviously, and we went straight to tape,
mm-hmm.
two track. But the thing was, what we did was we'd play the intro up to the first verse,
right.
Then we'd stop because there was no automation in those days.
That's right.
So we'd move the faders manually, and then when we got to the edit point, we would go, okay, we'll edit here, and then we'd take our hands off the faders and then mark where the faders were, and then run back 5 or 10 seconds, then move on to the next part. So the whole song, we'd do it in maybe 8 or 9 edits.
Right.
But it was all done in edits. Hunky Dory, Sticky Stars, Levinson, and Pinups.
Wow.
All in edits. And that was complicated,
yes.
But fun to do, because you had to balance in those days. Like, an example, a drummer would come in, so you'd have to mix the drums. You wouldn't have the luxury of digital where everything's on a separate track.
Right.
You'd have to mix all the toms and cymbals and possibly hi-hat on 2 tracks.
Really?
And you'd have the bass drum on one, the snare on another, and then a stereo toms, cymbals, and hi-hat. So you had to make sure, as you're EQing, you have to, in your mind, remember that after all the overdubs are done, are you hearing enough of the cymbals in EQ? Are they still coming through? And then you have to remember mastering. Because if the hi-hat was too bright, you can imagine after you've mastered everything, and the mastering guy is mastering the 2 tracks, left and right, that hi-hat boosts some mids or highs, that hi-hat is so out of balance.
Yeah.
Or the cymbals might be out of balance.
Right.
You know, so it was a very intricate thing that Ken actually taught me how to balance, like, the whole stereo drums, you know, I mean, sorry, all the, like, 15 channels of drums to 2 tracks.
That's very difficult. You got to have a great ear for that.
Yeah, I mean, but it took time, you know, it's like, but that was the art of it. That was the fun of it.
Right.
Now, everything on individual tracks on digital, the problem with digital, I think, it is hard to make decisions.
Right.
Because when you're doing a vocal, you don't have in the old days, you didn't have the luxury of having 10 tracks of vocals.
Exactly.
You know, you had to make decisions.
Yeah.
So, with digital, you can have 50 tracks of lead vocal. But the problem is, it's hard to make your mind up which one you like.
Yeah.
So it actually takes longer.
Well, all the great albums were made, you know, on the way you suggested, like, you know, Dark Side of the Moon, Alan Parsons.
Right.
I mean, that they didn't have the luxury of any of the new technology, you know.
And
the way they were looping, you know, they stretched out the tape and all that.
Right, that's what we used to do. Yeah, exactly. Like, to get that delay, like a John Lennon just delay.
Incredible. Incredible.
So, yeah, we had to measure the tape, and if it was too long, then we'd cut it. We'd have the tape going across the playback heads, the record heads of the 2-track, and then stretching it out over a mic.
Yep.
Stand.
Yeah, that's right. They had a mic stand. Yeah.
I mean, it was, we just experimented all the time. Like, actual tape phasing.
That's pretty cool.
You know, that was just like, you know, people, even now they go, tape phase, how did you do that?
Yeah.
You know? But it was great.
I did Top 40 Radio back in the late 70s, and
uh-huh.
we did a lot of editing, you know, splicing, a lot of tape splicing back in those days, you know. And I'm sure they don't do that like they used to either.
No. I mean, you know, when I work with somebody, an engineer that's doing digital, you know, working on the Pro Tools, so much can happen so quickly. Like, I'll go, you know, that vocal is a little bit too legato for me. Click, 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 click. Done. And I look at him, I go, oh, you fixed it? And he goes, yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Okay. I think there's one note, him going, man, you know, it's like, what?
Yeah.
You know, and then you get now when they do a chorus or something, then they just cut and paste.
Cut and paste, that's right.
Yeah, cut and paste, Dennis. And I go, boy, I you know, because, you know, I always think this. Does every chorus have to sound exactly the same?
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. You can add a bit here, change the vocal a little bit
there.
Sure. You know, just to give it some depth and, you know. But so many people now are just digital.
Yeah, no, we need guys like you.
Yeah, I know. I love it.
Yeah. It was there any difference? You know, you did a lot of fusion, you know. You know.
Yes.
Of course, Billy Cobham and Stanley Clark and all those guys. McLaughlin. Was there any difference recording? Did you have any difficulties recording fusion as opposed to, say, Judas Priest?
No, actually, fusion was easier.
Really?
Well, I mean, absolutely, because, you know, once we got the foundation, and to me, the bass and the drums, the foundation, the low end, the warmth, and we used to, like, when I worked with Billy Cobham, I mean, I remember I went to Electric Ladyland to, I think it was Making Magic album, and it was like 27 inputs, 27 mics I used.
Wow.
Because he had these octobombs, you know, like eight of them, so I had to put the mics inside those things. But it was like an art. Once I got the sound, he had two gong drums, he had three snare drums, he had three bass drums.
Yeah.
I mean, Billy Cobham is so amazing, you know, not only now, but in those days. I mean, he was experimental, and we just played around with sounds.
Mm-hmm.
That was the fun. Like, when I did the Bromatic Warrior, I mean, I played around with sounds on that album. And everybody says it's a great sounding album, it's very organic. And it was just, you know, because they wanted to experiment. Nowadays, drummers come in, they have the sounds, you know, and they go, I want to sound like this. I remember when people, I used to record somebody, like a drummer, and they would come in with, like, nowadays, and they come in with, like, five CDs, and they say, Dennis, I want my bass drum to sound like this guy. I want my snare to sound like this guy on this CD. And I look at them and I go, it's about your own individuality.
Exactly.
Why don't you find a sound that everybody will hear that sound and go, I know who that drummer is.
Yep.
Like when you hear Phil Collins, you know it's Phil Collins.
Exactly. Yep.
You know?
Yeah, I don't get that. I really don't.
I know. Nor me. And they get adamant about it, Dennis. I want that John Bonham bass drum.
Yeah.
I go, but your drum is not tuned that way, and this track doesn't have that feel of the song in those days. I mean, what are you saying? It's like, so, you know, but you try and get the best you can.
Sure.
You know?
It's funny. I always thought, like, the, you know, like Mahavishnu Orchestra, the improvisational performances, those type of things would be very difficult to produce, you know?
Right, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, actually, in actuality, why, you know, a lot of fusion people like working with me was not only the getting the recorded sound, but they would leave me alone to mix it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started, like, you know, when you hear Romantic Warrior, that's when I added a little tape phasing.
Yeah.
Or adding a little delay on this, or, you know, adding a certain reverb, like an EMT plate on the guitar.
Right.
And when they would come in and check it out, because they would sit in reception while I would be mixing, like a 20-second or 40-second section. And once I was happy with the balance, and then I would record it with all the moves, I call it audio candy.
Right.
When the drummer does a fill, I push the fill up. Not just the bass drum and snare. I get all the dynamics. You know, I play with the dynamics like a drummer.
Yep.
You know, and then I'd call them in, and then they would critique it and go, maybe a little Stanley, of course, a little more bass. You know, Stanley. Just how about just mixing it? Just the bass. No. You know, and I would do it that way, just in sections.
Yep. You produced the Inner Worlds album, right?
With John. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was great. I mean, an example of what experimenting, for instance, when I did Inner Worlds, we did it in France, the Chateau in France.
Uh-huh.
And when I met John, he said, I'm going to show you this guitar. I went, wow, you know, it looked amazing. And he goes, Dennis, the pickups have six separate outputs.
Wow.
Which were going to six mini Moogs. Now, Imagine that. Each string went to a separate mini Moog.
That's crazy.
Ah. I know. But that's what John was about. He was experimenting.
Yeah. Sure.
You know, and I loved that. I mean, it was just like, this is great. This is great. You know? And a lot of people, you know, they love that organic sound again.
Yes.
You know?
They
those
do.
Albums.
Yeah, John McLaughlin, he was incredible.
Yeah, was I did chat an album at Shakti.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a great album too.
Birds of Fire?
No, that's the one Ken Scott did. That's the one we did at Trident. That's the one I was saying. That's the one I forgot. Yeah, Inner Worlds. No, not Inner Worlds. Birds of Fire.
Birds of Fire.
Birds of Fire. That's the one Ken Scott did.
Yeah.
And it's a great sounding album too.
Great sounding. You know, you can tell right away when it's a well produced, well engineered album. You know, it
right.
just
definitely,
sticks out.
Definitely.
Just sticks out.
You know, yeah, absolutely. You know, when we did, well, there was a producer that used to come to Trident all the time, and he was the producer of Elton John.
Yes.
And his name was Gus Dudgeon.
Right.
And I wanted to be like him. You know, I was a tape op.
Uh-huh.
I'd watch him, and I just watched the way, like, dynamically how he would mix. Like, if a bass player did a slide on the bass,
mm-hmm.
he would actually push the fader up, like 2 or 3 dBs to accentuate that slide. But he would do it on everything. If the drummer would go on the hi-hat, a certain mm-hmm. rhythm,
right.
just for that brief moment, he would push it up just a couple of dBs. And I would go, man, he's painting a picture.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And I call that audio candy.
Right.
And I watched him over. We did many albums together. I mean, as a tape op. He would use Robin Cable, he would use Ken Scott, he would use David Henschel, and it was like, I was enamored about the way he mixed. And sure enough, you know, I mean, eventually, I mean, that's what I do, you know? I love dynamics, I love playing with it.
So one of the first artists you started working with, Tommy Bolin. I need to talk about Tommy for Trace's sake.
I know, Trace. He's a great guy.
He's a great guy. He's
yeah,
wonderful.
Yeah, he is. I mean, I'm glad he introduced us to getting
exactly.
get together. That's great.
Yeah, we did a Tommy Bolin tribute, and we had the guys from Barnstorm, you know, Vital and Pascarelli, Kenny Pascarelli on the show, and you know, it was all about Tommy, and you worked with Tommy in the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was at Trident, and, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the bookings girl said, Dennis, there's a guy called Tommy Boland coming in, and he wants to just play, I think the album is Teaser. He wants to play this yep. album and just listen to it in the room. And I went, in the remix suite, and I went, okay. He goes, you want to do it? I said, yeah, fine. So, you know, I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden the door opens, and in comes this guy, Tommy Bolin, with long hair, uh-huh. and he's dressed like I've never seen anybody dressed before, you know? He had his bright-colored shirt and pants with bell-bottoms, you know, at the bottom, and he just comes in, he's got this great smile, you know, had some earrings, I stood up and I went, hi, I'm Dennis. And he goes, hi, I'm Tommy. And I went, hi, Tommy, how are you? He goes, great, man. And I went, okay. He goes, this is Barry Fay. You know, and I went, hi, Barry Fay. And then he's my manager.
Uh-huh.
And he had a little entourage with him. And then what happened, how I got the gig was, he goes, look, they've got Dennis, this is a 24 track. I just want you to play a track and let me hear it in this room. Thank you. And I went, he was so polite and so nice, you know, and immediately I wasn't nervous. He sat right next to me and he's smoking his little cigarette thing mm-hmm. and he's looking at me and I'm looking at him and I thought, what a nice guy, you know,
yeah.
pleasant. So we put the tape up and then I forget what track it was, but I pushed up the faders and the first, this is how I basically got the gig. I pushed up the bass and I went, and I wrote down bass on a piece of tape.
Uh-huh.
And then I go bass drum, snare, and then the kit, the whole kit. And then the next track was like, you know, like a mono piano or something. And then from that moment on, it was like rhythm guitar 1, rhythm guitar 2, double tracked, rhythm chorus rhythm. Baba guitar, solo harmony, and then I just, it was another like 10 tracks of guitar, you know? So I kept smiling as I'm putting up all these guitar tracks that were like obliterating everybody else, you know? And I kind of glanced at him and I said, Tommy, don't tell me. You must be the guitarist. And he looked at me, and for some unknown reason, he thought that was hysterical, you know. But I had a little smile on my face because it was kind of funny, you know. But he goes, I like this guy. Barry, I like this guy, Dennis. I like you, man.
That's cool.
And he gave me a hug, and I gave him a hug, and that's how we started.
Awesome.
You know?
Yeah.
It was fantastic. Then he goes, Dennis, I got to do a couple more tracks, and I want to go to New York, Electric Lady. Will you do it with me? And I said, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then I flew out there, and then we made history.
Yeah. You know? It's amazing. It's such a shame. The guy, you know, he had so much more to give us, you know?
I know. When we finished Private Eyes,
uh-huh.
It was 3 months after the album was out that he died.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And somebody called me and said, Dennis, Tommy Bowen. I went, what? I couldn't fathom. Like, you can't be serious.
Right.
25 years old.
Exactly. Exactly.
It was exactly, I was at my age, you know? It was unbelievable. I just couldn't believe it. You know, but so many people, you know, Greg and people that are keeping it, you know, going, Tommy Bowen and that, you know, thing on the internet, on, you know, it was just like, you know, I couldn't, how big Tommy Bowen now is becoming, even more so.
Well, Trace has done a remarkable job, and it's almost like he's never left us, you know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Doing a great job.
He's doing
Bobby's out there, too.
Yep, he's doing a wonderful job. Wonderful job with that.
You know,
one of the albums they always say it's one of the best albums ever, and I know it was very much, they did this album very quickly,
right.
And it was all improvisation, and I talked to Billy Cobham about this. It was the Spectrum album.
Right.
And actually, I think Billy Cobham produced that album. Well, what do you think about the Spectrum album? Was it?
I like it. I like it very much. And especially when Tommy Bolin and Billy Cobham are playing, doing that track.
Oh, they were incredible.
Oh, my God. It was like magic. It was just, they blended so beautifully. And it just shows you the diversity of Tommy Bolin.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, from rock to blues to, I mean, it was unbelievable. There was no end in sight. He was just amazing whatever he did. You know, he experimented too. I mean, when we did Private Eyes, you know, one of the tracks, he goes, Dennis, I want to go DI. I don't want to use an amp. And I went, DI? I said, really? You don't want to use like a DI and an amp, and we'll just mix it and push up more of the DI? No, I want DI. I want to experiment. And I went, you got it, Tommy. And sure enough, you know, he was in charge of his own sound, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
He knew, he wanted to experiment and be talked about, like, and he was so humble, very humble.
Right.
Never said that, you know, when somebody would come in and go, Tommy, you know, you're great, man. He'd go, thank you, man. Thank you.
Yeah.
Very humble. Didn't go, yeah, I know.
Right, exactly.
No?
Yeah.
It was amazing.
I was very lucky to see him. He was playing with Deep Purple and the James Gang. I saw him in
That's
both
right.
of those bands. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great guitar player.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about Brand X.
Brand X. Now, that was fun to do. Because there was Phil Collins, Robin Lumley, Percy Jones, John Goodsoul. And it was amazing because they were like, say Return to Forever,
right.
But British, you know?
Yep.
British side of fusion. And they're basically the first band to do it, really, I think, at that time.
Right.
And apart from John McLaughlin, obviously. But it was like, it was fun working with them because that was another experimental album.
Right.
You know, especially with Phil Collins, because Phil, you know, he was in Genesis, and, you know, and there he is playing drums on this kind of fusion album. And but it showed diversity, how good he is as a drummer.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a heavy backbeat, a few fills here and there. It was very intricate what he was doing. And I think he was more contented having that freedom of playing what he wanted to play. You know? And so when we were doing the album and everything, you know, he loved to experiment. I used a lot of room mics and, you know, a lot of dynamics. When you hear Unorthodox Behavior or my rock and roll, I mean, I went crazy on the dynamics. You know, I mean, to such an extent. And Ray, this is the honest truth. We were at Morgan Studios.
Right.
And one of the tracks has a huge, you know, Percy Jones on bass.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Sure.
Unbelievable. No one sounds like Percy Jones. So what happens is that there's a moment in the track where he goes, and he slides way up, you know. And what happens is that the dynamics are so loud at that moment that if you have, we used to put the volume, or Robin Lumley used to put the volume, say, at like from, say, one is pretty loud,
right.
Two's fairly loud. So he would have it at, say, five.
Okay.
You know, all the way round. So when it got to, it was loud on these monitors. And then when it got to that bass slide, it would go, and the speakers would just blow. They would cut off. The fuses would go. But we'd do it every morning before we started working on the next track, or any track. We would put that moment on that mix up.
That's funny.
Line it up, so we'd hear like 5 or 10 seconds of music, and it would go whoop, and the maintenance would have a ladder. I'm running in with a box of fuses, change the fuses, and go, okay, guy, we'll have more fuses tomorrow.
That's fun.
You know, and we'd do it every day.
It's rock and roll.
It's rock and roll. We're having a good time here.
That's right.
You know. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I wish Phil would do more of that, you know, because he's such a gifted drummer, you know?
I know.
You know, I was disappointed when he got into the you know, like the R&B stuff he was starting to do and all the
right.
covers. I didn't like that at all, you know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I like, you know, Smiling Face.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like this way he, you know, he was getting it out of his system.
Right.
Very commercial,
right.
Very you know, radio, and sold millions and millions of copies, you know. But then he would go back with Genesis,
right.
Do his thing, go on tour. So he was, you know, I mean, I think he was experimenting again.
Yeah.
But it shows how great he is as a songwriter.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know?
Yeah.
And singer. I mean, when we did Brand X, I think it's on either on Orthodox Behavior or Rock and Roll, he's doing a vocal track. And it was the first time he's ever sang. So, you know, and I thought, what a great voice. Now, shoot forward a few years, and Genesis, Peter Gabriel leaves the band, okay? So the band comes to Trident, and they're auditioning singers. Now, I'm mixing Grand X upstairs in the remix suite,
right.
While Genesis have a whole line of these guys that come in, they know the track they're singing on, it's all pre-done, and they would come in, the mic would be set up, and off they go. And the band would just say, okay, and your name is so-and-so, so-and-so, we'll let you know. And this goes on for a few days, and I'm with the manager of Genesis in the remix suite, because of Phil Collins and everything, you know, his association with Phil Collins.
Right, right.
And all of a sudden, I think it was David Henshall comes up and says, we found a singer. And the manager, and we look at and I myself, we look at each other and went, wow, really? So we went downstairs to the studio, and we sat there in front of the console, and there's chairs at the back of the console. But we're sitting in front, me, the manager, and David Henshall, and all of a sudden, you know, they play this track, and we hear this voice, and it sounds just like Peter Gabriel, you know? We went like, wow, my God,
yeah.
Who is this? And then Phil pops his head up behind the console, and says, it's me! And we went, what? You know, and that was it. He was the singer.
You know, he blew away a lot of people sounding like Peter Gabriel, you know?
Right, I know. I don't think his intention was to be like that.
No.
Or a bit of it, maybe, but that was, you
That's
know,
his voice.
It sounded so good, though.
Yeah.
You know?
Because, you know, I'm a big Genesis fan, you know, I'm a big prog rock guy, and Genesis, you know, they were like a religion. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We were really serious about it. That's why a lot of people got mad at him when he went to the, you know, R&B stuff.
I totally go with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But, you know, he was amazing. For that transition to happen from the great Peter Gabriel, you know, that was almost an impossible feat, you know?
Right, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it was a challenge for him, you know, like, because can you imagine people saying, well, you sound just like Peter Gabriel.
Yeah,
It must have been like a head trip for him.
But I'm glad he did.
Exactly, absolutely.
And Trick of the Tail, you know, that's probably one of my favorite albums, you know?
Right. Yeah, yeah. I think, and David Henschel, I think, produced that.
Yeah.
Great
album.
He was a great engineer, producer.
Yep.
I mean, you know, really unbelievable. I mean, when you listen to Yellow Brick Road, you know, some of those sounds, a lot of those sounds on that album, just unbelievable. You know, great sounding record.
Now, you won the Grammy with Stanley Clark Band. What was the criteria for winning a Grammy with that album?
Well, I think what happened was because he won a Grammy and everybody liked the sound and everything, Stanley said, Dennis, you know, you're getting an award too. You're getting a Grammy too for doing the album.
Right.
Sonically, it sounds really good.
And yeah.
I went, well, okay, great. I won't not accept it. You know, I went, absolutely. And I didn't go to the Grammys. It was sent to me.
Really?
And I went, how great is that? You know, it's like an honor. Absolute honor.
That's definitely a good thing to have under your belt.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when we did Romantic Warrior, Romantic Warrior was nominated for a Grammy, you know, and I was so hoping for that one because Romantic Warrior, to me, I've met a lot of fusion people. As you look at my resume, it's like I got like 60 albums out of that.
Exactly.
One album. But everybody says to me that Dennis is like the sound. The sound you got on that fusion album, Romantic Warrior. I mean, I picked up the bass when I heard Stanley Clark. I picked up, you know, the guitar when I heard Aldo Meola. And, you know, from that one project, I finished a couple of years ago, but I did 7 albums with Stanley Clark, 5 albums with Aldo Meola, like 2 albums or 3 albums with Lenny White.
Lenny White
is the only one I didn't carry on working with him. Yeah, I think he had his own engineer and producer, I think he produces himself.
Yeah. Yeah, Stanley Clark's an amazing bass player. He's always been considered one of the top bass players in history.
Yeah, and he was voted years ago twice for being the world's best bass player.
Yep.
You know, for him, I mean, Stanley's such a great person. I mean, you know, he's a workaholic.
Yeah.
He's a workaholic. He loves, you know, as much time as he can write track. He writes movie music too.
Yeah.
You
know? A lot of people do nowadays. And also video games. They do a lot of video games.
Yep.
That's what, you know, he should be doing a lot of that other stuff, you know?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
Especially movies. I could see you doing, you know, some movie scores. Right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm all for, you know, right now, there's a person, you know, I was semi-retired.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, you know, I thought, I'm going to go on the internet, you know, and just see, you know, what's going on. So I went to Austin, Texas, and I looked at some record labels.
Yep.
And one was 9 Mile Records, and there's Modern Outsider Records.
Right.
And I was looking, and all of a sudden I see this Elijah Ford. You know, and I go, oh, I wonder what he's doing, you know. So all of a sudden, you know, I type it in, also, you know, and I get these demos. I get these tracks, and I'm listening to it. And I go, well, not demos, I heard some tracks. And I went, wow, I like this guy's voice, you know, and I like the way he writes.
Mm-hmm.
It's retro, but it's got modern sides to it.
Right.
That's going on right now.
Right.
So I call him up, and I said, Elijah, this is Dennis McKay. And he goes, yeah. You know, I thought, check the internet, please. I don't want to boast about what I've done. You know? And he goes, so, Dennis, what do you do? I said, well, listen, I love your voice. I love the way you write. I'd like to produce you or co-produce with you. You know, he goes, well, okay. He says, look, I'll send some tracks. You know, what I'm doing right now. It's taken me 2 years to write these tracks. You know, and he sent me like 14 tracks altogether.
Right.
So, yeah, and I picked one. And he goes, give me some ideas of what you're thinking of. So, you know, I spent a few days at home, and I called him up, and I said, listen, on the bridge, I would do this. On the chorus, maybe try that. And he liked those ideas, because nowadays, it's not so much they look at your resume and go, oh, okay, that's what he's done, but what can he do for me?
Right.
You know? And it's as black and white as that.
It's a shame. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I started like, okay, and I told him what I would do, and he goes, Dennis, I like these ideas.
Right.
He said, before I commit, you know, can you do it to another track? You know, and I said, yeah, you know, because I was excited that he was excited. Anyway, I did it to like three tracks, and then he goes, Dennis, okay, listen, I want you to do these three tracks. But the nice thing is, I met him, great guy, incredibly talented. Great voice. He's out. So, you know, I did 9 tracks altogether with him, or 9 or 10 tracks. And he's got a few more there. And it's going to come out this year.
Good.
But I hope people remember his name, Elijah Ford.
Is this his first, album?
Yes.
Okay.
Basically, yeah. He's done some other, he's done an EP before, I think.
Right.
But this new stuff is unbelievable.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It's something, you know, I got very excited about it because I could be in tune with it. It's something, it reminded me a little bit of, you know, retro, but with a nice vibe to it.
Sure.
And his vocal, yeah, he captures everything. He's a great guitarist, too. I mean, amazing.
I'll look for his website. We'll put his link, you know, on all the sites.
Right.
And if he's got a YouTube, right. YouTube video or anything, we'll put it on there, too. We'll promote it.
Fantastic.
Definitely.
I know he'll be excited.
Oh, yeah. We want to help any good new artist nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? I mean, that's, you know, I'm always searching. I'm always, like, looking for people. Because I'm semi-retired, but I want to get back into it more, you know, in production, arrangements, critiquing tracks.
You're too young to retire. What's the matter with you?
I know. I'm only 108.
There's so much golf, you know? There's so much golf you can play.
I know. When people say, Dennis, you've done over 100 and something albums, you know?
Exactly.
But the thing is, when I was doing fusion albums, it was like one a week.
Yeah.
Every 2 weeks. I'm not joking. I did something like 10 or 11 albums in 1 year.
Wow.
You know?
That's incredible. So
the power of the players.
Yeah.
I mean, with these fusion players like Steve Gadd, Billy Cobham.
Yep.
You know, and all these great guitars, they do it in 1 or 2 takes.
That's right.
You know, so once you've got the sound, I mean, that's it. You just punch it into record and off you go.
Yeah.
You know, because they just want to capture the vibe and let's go. Come on, man. Let's go.
Exactly.
And, yeah, within a week, the album is recorded.
Yeah.
Overdubbed. And then I would mix it, take 3 or 4 days, and it's done.
Amazing.
Next, you know.
You were involved in a very controversial album, Judas Priest.
Don't mention it.
Well, it wasn't your fault. I mean, they didn't even write the song.
I know. Stained Glass,
yeah.
I know. And it's, you know, it was so funny because what happened was I got a deposition.
Right.
You know, and first of all, they were on every channel, you know, on the news and chat shows.
Yeah, exactly. I remember.
And if they would have lost, you know, it would have changed history.
Yeah, it would have.
Because it's freedom of speech.
Yep.
You know, and all they were saying was, because two kids, they went into a park.
Uh-huh.
After taking drugs and this, that, and the other, whatever they did, I'm not 100% certain, but they were out of it, say. So one of them said, look, I'm going to shoot myself, or, you know, and he shoots himself and he kills and dies. And then the other guy got this gun and shot. And he blew half his face off.
Wow.
But he survived. He survived. So years and years, like 25 years go by, and the kid dies. And the parents decide that it was subliminal messages on that album.
Right.
Because they kept playing that album over and over and over. And that's how it started.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not joking, right? So many times people say to me, come on, Dan, we're friends. Was there any subliminal messages in there? And I go, no. And they go, come on, Dennis. I can give you a bit of money. Tell me, come on. You know, I go, nope. It's nothing, seriously. There was no subliminal messages. But the way the judge summed it up, because he came to the studio and Eddie Kramer was there.
Right.
And Eddie Kramer remixed it. Like, basically, copying the original mix,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And the judge was sitting in the room and made a decision that, you know, okay, and this is what he said. This is the final thing. He said, at a certain moment when the track, a certain moment when this title or of the song stops, it gives the audible impression, because you hear the echoes going over the stop,
Hmm.
And that was it.
And that was it.
That was it. And that, and then everything was like fine after that. And I just went, whew. But, yeah, I know. It was very scary.
That is scary. Yeah. I mean, you know, you can interpret any song to say anything, really.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know?
Yeah, that's, yeah. That's one to remember. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. That was a great album too.
Great. Yeah.
I thought because I did Pat Travers.
Yeah.
You know, when I did those three albums, the manager David Hemmings managed Judas Priest, and you know, after I finished, I think what was it called? One of Pat Travers' ones, the last one. But anyway, what happened was I had to meet Judas Priest in a pub just outside Trident. And I never forget this. I had my resume printed out.
Right.
You know, and by then I mean, I had like 25 albums done. So I had it under my arm, and then I go into the pub, and I think the pub was called The Ship in London, in Soho. And I walk in, and there's Judas Priest, Rob and Kenny and Glenn and the drummer, and they're all sitting there. And I walk in, and I see them. And I, you know, and I was not cocky. I wasn't, but I just kind of like had a little bit of a, okay, you know, let me see what happens here, you know.
Right.
I'm sure I'm going to get the gig, you know, hey. Because I did Pat Travers, and the manager has already recommended me to Judas Priest to produce. So I walk up to the table, and Rob Halford looks at me, and he goes, yes. I said, hi, I'm Dennis Mackay. And he goes, hello, Dennis. I went, hi, Rob. He goes, what's that under your arm? And I went, oh, and I took it, my resume, and I gave it to Rob Halford. And he goes, what is this? And he goes, I said, oh, it's my resume, thinking that they'll all read it and go, oh, wow, this is
right,
my Rob Halford grabs my resume, looks at it, and starts ripping it up. He rips it up in tiny pieces, doesn't talk to me. Of course, I'm standing there looking down at these four guys.
Great story.
And I'm stuttering, like, what are you doing, you know? And he rips it all up, and he throws it up in the air, and it comes down like, what do you call it?
Confetti?
Yeah, exactly. And it all falls on the table, and, you know, one of the guy's heads, you know. And Rob Halford looks at me and goes, so, Dennis, that's your resume. But the thing is, what we want to know is, what are you going to do for us?
Yeah, same story.
Yeah, and I just looked at him, and I went, well, and I grabbed a chair, and I sat down, and I talked about sounds, and get your own individuality in the sound, and, you know, and I remember when I was recording that album, you know how the rhythm guitar sound, it took 5 days.
Really?
In the studio, yeah.
Huh.
5 days to get that guitar sound. Because they came in with like 12 or 15 Marshall cabinets.
Yep.
You know? And I had to put my ear, can you believe that? I'm an idiot. I was in those days. But I put while they're playing a rhythm, like Glenn would just strumming a chord. And I had to put my finger in my ear, put my head against the cabinet, and pick the speakers that weren't slightly distorted. So, you know, that took a whole day.
Oh,
and then,
yeah.
I mean, we had to build cabinets out of the best speakers out of those cabinets.
Right.
But a lot of people say those guitar sounds and rhythms sound, you know, very organic and beautiful, you know. But it took a hell of a long time, I tell you.
Mm. I tell you, man, I'm the one who's going to brag about your resume. I'm not tearing anything up, okay?
Okay.
You worked with so many great, you know, Mick Ronson was a favorite of mine, guitar player. You did Slaughter on 10th Avenue.
Yes.
As well. You worked with Whitney Houston. Jack Bruce, Jet Set Jewel, you were a producer on that album.
Yep.
I love Jack. I was able to talk to him the year he passed, and he's such a funny guy, you know? He was a funny guy.
Great sense of humor.
We didn't want to talk about Ginger Baker too much, so.
No, I know. You know, he told me something I thought was very funny. He said, you know, Dennis, when I was on stage, he goes, me and, you know, Ginger, we'd kind of like have a couple of drinks before we go on stage, and you know, he was always rattling my cage, and I'll always be rattling his cage. And he goes, what? This is funny. Ginger Baker, with a playing like whatever track in front of like a couple of thousand people, and Ginger Baker had a habit of like hitting the cymbal, like the right cymbal and letting go of the stick, and the stick will swizzle like weesh, 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 and hit Jack Bruce at the back of the head. Right? And Jack's telling me this story, and I'm trying it, and he's saying it kind of seriously, and I'm keeping a straight face saying, really? Like, really? You know? And he goes, Dennis, you know, the bastard kept doing this over and over again. So one night, he said, I just got pissed, mad. He said, when it hit him in the back of the head, he took his strap off his face and dived over the drums and started fighting with Ginger Baker. And he said, Dennis, the whole audience stood up. They saw it as part of the act. And they're all clapping and, yes, yeah.
That's funny.
You know, and we just went in, we went into it, punching each other in the face, hitting each other. And I just started laughing. I thought, Jack, I said, that is hysterical. And he goes, well, it wasn't at the time. I went, no, it's funny, you know.
Yeah, Ginger didn't have much of a sense of humor, did he?
No, not then.
No.
You know. Oh.
You know what I noticed? I wanted to know a few other things that you did. Gong was another album that you did.
Alan Holdsworth.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
I think Gazoos, right?
Produced
Gazoos.
Gazoos, I think it's called Gazoos.
Yep. Another.
He was a great guitarist too.
Yes. Yes.
He had his own style.
Yep.
You know, I think he was a guitarist. Other guitarists would listen to him.
I think you're right.
You know.
Yeah.
Because his style was so, for people that don't play a guitar, kind of like frown, like, what is that? What chord is he doing?
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
But so Alan was great.
Yeah.
So it's really great. It's a shame he's gone.
Yeah, I know.
Another one bites the dust.
A lot of them bit the dust, unfortunately.
I know. Mick Ronson.
Yeah.
When he went, oh man.
Very sad. You know?
Yeah,
and so young. So young. Well, you got a George Martin story that you told me already, and it's about Jeff Beck.
Yes. You want me to tell that story?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. You know, I was mixing Brand X at Trident, and in those days, you know, everybody's smoking pot. I wasn't into pot. I was more into alcohol in those days, pints of beer, pints of Bass. And, you know, like it was kind of 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I've had like two or three pints, you know, and everybody else has been drinking and smoking pot. So the room, and then those days people would smoke cigarettes in the studio, in the control room. They don't do that now, obviously. But so all of a sudden my assistant engineer says the phone rings and he picks up the phone and he goes, Dennis. So I turn the volume down. I said, yep. He goes, George Martin for you. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, you know. And Roy Thomas Baker used to, like, play tricks on people, you know. He'd say, he's a little out there.
Sure.
And you think, oh, someone's just pulling my leg. So, you know, I looked at the assistant. I went, yeah, sure. And I turned the volume up. He goes, Dennis, it's for you. It's for you. And I went, oh, God. So I turned the volume down. I stood up. And I'm sitting. I grabbed the phone. I go, hello. And I hear this voice going, hello. Dennis Mackay. You know, and I went, yes, it is, yes. And he says, Dennis Mackay. I said, yes, it is. This is Dennis Mackay, yes. He goes, this is George Martin here. And I went, George Martin. And then all of a sudden, this is when the Beatles have just split up. So I'm going, I recognize that voice. And I went, and I start to stand up. You've got to visualize, like,
stood up.
George Martin is called.
At attention.
I slowly stood up and the phone against my head and I go, and I don't get, I've had a few beers and I went, yes? He goes, listen, Dennis, Jeff Beck has shown some interest in working with you. Would you be interested? I said, absolutely. And I wasn't really concerned about Jeff Beck. I'm talking to George Martin, the Beatles producer. And I'm like, yeah, he goes, now, Dennis, he said, look, I got a studio 15 minutes away from where you are. It's called Air London. I'm sure you've heard of it. And I said, yes, yes. He goes, well, where would you like to record it? I don't know how many tracks it will be, but where would you like to do it? I said, well, how about here at Trident? He goes, oh, okay, I'll be there in 15 minutes. And I went, okay, and I put the phone down, and I said to my sister, coffee, I want to drink coffee, I'm going to sober up, oh my God, he's coming here, and I told the band, you know, and I said, George Martin's on his way here, what? John Goodsoul, Percy Jones, really, what, and I kind of had a cup of coffee, I ran lying downstairs, and in comes George Martin. And he goes, hello. And I went, and I'm just looking at him in awe, you know, three-piece suit, tie, right. white shirt.
Right.
And I went, hi, George, you know, and he goes, okay, well, show me the studio, Dennis. And I took him to the studio. He said, I've been here many years ago.
Right.
And he's looking around. He goes, okay. He said, that's great. Now, Ray, to take this even further, when I, about 2 weeks later, Jeff Beck comes in, and the keyboard player and the drummer, and we're laying down the track, and I've got the sound already, and we've got the multi-track in record, and George Martin's sitting right next to me, and I've done the sounds, and he loved the sounds, and, you know, but I'm just in awe. I'm working with George Martin, you know, and my heart is beating a little fast, you know, and all of a sudden, as we're tracking, you know, he looks at me and he goes, Dennis, I like the sound. I really like the sound, you know, Dennis. It's very nice. Very nice. And I went, I'm glad you like it, George. Because he said, Dennis, you can call me George. I went, I felt like, thank you, George. You know, like, wow, are we close or what? You know, anyway, so what happens, it was 10 o'clock at night, and George Martin said, okay, it's a wrap. And Jeff Beck, with the other members of the band, they leave. And George Martin, this is honest truth, he turns around to me, and my assistant is sitting by the multi-track in the control room. Right. Now, George Martin turns around to me, and he says, Dennis, he said, I've really enjoyed, you know, I know we're booked here for a week. He said, but I'm really enjoying working with you. Is it, you can ask me anything. And I looked at him, and he looked at me again. He goes, and I mean anything. And I went, wow, okay. So I look at him, and I go, you know, I said, how is it that John Lennon and Paul McCartney are just molded together and they work so great together?
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, okay, all right, good question. He said, listen, what it is this, and this is the best way I can explain it.
Right.
He goes, Paul McCartney is a perfectionist,
mm-hmm.
an absolute perfectionist. Yep. He will go over a bass part for 6 to 7 hours.
Right.
I mean, and he's a great bass player, but he will take his time and get it right. He's a perfectionist. And he goes, now, John Lennon likes a little bit of buzz on his amp.
Right.
He likes a little bit of distortion here and there. He goes, now, Dennis, what do like poles of a magnet do? And I said, they repel. He goes, exactly.
Go. Ah.
He said, because they're opposites, they attracted together.
How about that?
And I went, wow, what a great way to explain it.
Exactly.
You know, perfect way. You don't have to go through a big story. And so now imagine, as he says that to me, he goes like, he said, so Dennis, that's the attraction. And I went, wow. So my assistant, Ray, you're not going to believe this. He gets up on the multi-track, comes over and says, listen, guys. And he's only like 18 years old, but he goes, listen, guys. And I'm going, guys? Just Mr. Martin here. No, right? He goes, listen, guys, I know you'll be gabbing all night. What time do you want to start tomorrow? And I'm looking at my assistant going, George Martin's telling us stories about the Beatles. We're not reading about it. We're not hearing about it. We're hearing it from the producer who did it with them. You know,
Very cool.
I'm looking at my assistant and I'm furious. I'm beyond anger, you know, and I'm looking at him and I went, and George Martin goes, Dennis, we'll start at what, 10:30 tomorrow? What do you think? And I said, perfect. And he looks, and we both look at the guy, and the guy said, okay, you'll see, I'll be in at 10, Dennis, bye-bye. And he leaves right in the middle of George Martin telling stories. And then George Martin looks at me and he says this. He goes, Dennis, I can tell you something about that guy. And I went, what's that, George? Because I felt embarrassed. He goes, I said, what's that, George? He goes, he will never make it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And sure enough, the guy was fired.
He's fired. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
What's the matter with people?
I know.
Oh, I would have been one of those guys. I'm not worthy.
I know. I mean, think about it. I mean, the stories that he can tell, you know, he was there.
Yeah.
You know? The magic
face to face.
Of the writers and the Beatles, I mean, period.
Yep.
You know?
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Have you ever met Jeff Emmerich?
Yeah, Jeff Emmerich?
Yes.
Because when we did Judas Priest, the controversial album, it was like he remixed the track in the studio and I was there.
Okay.
And I'd met him before when I did Billy Cobham. I went to Electric Ladyland.
Very cool.
And there was Jeff Emmerich.
Yep.
You know, yeah. He's done a lot of stuff.
Yes, he has.
A lot of heavy stuff.
I just want to remind everybody, you were there with George Martin because of the Wired album, right?
No.
No. That wasn't.
That was the Wired album. Well, yeah, because of the Wired album.
Yeah.
That was the Wired album, yeah.
You were working on the Wired album, which is one of Jeff Beck's best albums.
Oh, great. Fantastic. You know, I love hearing that. You know, it makes me feel so proud, you know.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Honored. Because, like, Jeff was such a great guitarist.
Oh, he's amazing.
Man.
I didn't learn until later that he never used a pick, you know.
I know. I mean, a lot of people don't know, like, Queen, right?
Right, Brian May, yep.
Okay, how he gets his sound. Okay, a lot of people go, well, it sounds metallic.
It sounds,
you know, and in those days, I think he still does. But, you know, like, one of your dimes over here?
Uh-huh.
Like quarter, and then you got the dime.
Yeah.
We used to have a thing, a similar size, called a sixpenny piece.
Right.
And he used to use that.
Really? Huh.
Yeah, to get the sound. So it sounds a little metallic, you know, and that's how he got his sound.
Yeah, Jeff is like one of a kind. You know,
very
hard to reproduce what he does. But you know what? I was watching a video the other day. One of my favorite guitar players was Roy Buchanan. I don't know if you remember him or not.
Yeah, I've heard the name. Yes, absolutely.
And he was from, I'm originally from the D.C. area. He was from D.C., from that area, too. And he did a lot of that early Jeff Beck sound way back when. You know, I didn't know that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there was so much. I mean, look, there's a lot of talent nowadays.
Right.
But when you think of great albums, you know, a lot of them was just then.
Yes.
You know, there were so many great albums.
There's so many, you know.
You know, and you just can't. And every time they come up, I mean, there's a whole thing about Trident Studios that came up the other day, and it's like a video thing, and you just type in Trident, it comes up, and you just play it, and it just shows you the amount of work, you know, with the Nilsson, Harry Nilsson, Carl Simons, and Bowie, and Lou Reed, and I mean, just these classic bands.
And of course, they had the famous piano, right?
We did. The Trident piano was such a great piano because your song was written on that piano.
Yep.
You know, and a Trident, and you know that was amazing.
That is amazing. That's history. That's history. Dennis, here's a question I ask everybody, and I get some very interesting answers. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform, or in your case, collaborate, engineering-wise, or produce, who would that be? You can pick somebody from the past that's no longer here.
Bowie?
Really?
Yeah, because Bowie, to me, I mean, I used to call him... Ken Scott wrote a book called From Ziggy Stardust, or something... Abbey Road to Ziggy Stardust.
Right.
Okay. Ken Scott wrote it. And I saw Ken, and a few years ago while he was writing the book, we met in a pub, and he said, Dennis, I want to hear some stories about Bowie. He said, I can't, you know, and I know you've got a good memory about, you know, when we worked with him. And I said, yeah. I said, oh, one take Bowie. He goes, oh my God, you remember that? And I said, yeah, absolutely I do. And every vocal, a lot of people don't believe me when I say that. I sat there through these albums, Hunky Dory, Ziggy Stardust, Lansing, and Pinups.
Wow.
Bowie would do the lead vocal in one take.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. We never overdubbed. We never went, oh, he's slightly flat there, he's a little sharp there. David, you know, we'll go back and drop you in. Nope. There was one take Bowie. Even 5 years, the one he cries on, 5 years, my brain hurts alive. I mean, he's crying on that track.
Yeah.
And he came up with one take. He cried in tune, can you believe it? And he came upstairs, and he's wiping his eyes, you know, and I'm just looking at him going, talent, this man. I mean, not only that, right, when he was doing backing vocals, I told this to Ken, there was a moment on, say, change it, turn and face the strain, changes, on the backing vocals. When Bowie laid that down, he wanted to double track it. So he laid it down first, and then he goes, okay, here we go for the double. And he started double tracking it. But the thing is, as he's doubling it, it started to phase. Son and face your change, it's a change. You know, and a lot of people must know what phasing is.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, Ken looked at me, and I'm looking at Ken, and Bowie stops, and he looks up at the control room, and he says, Ken, can you take that effect out of my headphones?
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, David, there is no effect. you're singing and breathing 99.99999 at the same time as the original vocal.
Wow.
And it was phasing. And he goes, so Ken says, David, could you sing slightly out of time? Can you imagine? Bowie, could you sing slightly out of time, please? Because you're phasing. You're phasing, you know.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah. And it's one take Bowie.
You know,
I'd love to work with him again. I mean, you know, I could tell you so many stories about Bowie. I mean, unbelievable. Unbelievable stories.
The way he ended, you know, was... A true artist, you know, the way he had.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. I mean, you think about it. I didn't know that he had 4 heart attacks when he was doing that album.
Wow. Really? I didn't know that either. Huh?
Yeah, he had 4 heart attacks.
Poor guy.
And then rushed to the hospital, but he still persisted and still carried on with Tony Visconti.
Yep.
And then the album is done, and then he passes away.
Yeah.
I think a couple of days before Grammys, I think.
I was working on trying to get an interview with Bowie, probably 6 months before he passed away.
Oh.
That's probably why they never hooked me up, because he was having issues.
Yeah, I mean, so sad. And no one, and you know, again, nobody knew about it.
Yeah, that's
Tony Visconti, I've seen an interview with him, and he said he had to sign like a waiver or something where he couldn't talk about it, you know?
Yeah.
But you can imagine how tragic it must have been. Because I noticed on the last video that I saw was he was so frail and, you know.
Yeah.
Sad.
It is sad. I wrote one quick question. Why on some artists, why do they have multiple producers, multiple engineers on an album? I know Whitney Houston does that. She's got a huge entourage.
I think because of different styles of music.
Right.
You know, if you've got like a kind of, it sounds more disco. You wouldn't use a rock and roller to do that.
Right.
Producer, you know? So that's why they have 3 or 4 or 5 different producers, especially in those days. Because,
right.
And they still do it, I know. But it's like, you know, it was just finessing it. Like, who's the best at rock?
Right.
Who's the best at, you know, rap? You know, who can do... And that's and you pay these guys and they come and they do their track, couple of tracks, and then they're out. You know, and then, you know, when I worked with Whitney Houston...
Uh-huh.
And on the Whitney album, I mean, the album sold like 35 million copies.
Yep, yep.
You know, and it's in the Hall of Fame.
Yep.
And it's just so nice, because all I did, I worked with a guy called Jelly Bean Benitez.
That name sounds familiar.
I think they were dating at the time.
Okay.
Yeah, and he produced that one track, and I only spent like 2 or 3 days with him. And it was, I never met her, but we worked on the track. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. 3 or 4 days on the track, and it was great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a great guy. But the album is just so successful for Whitney.
Yeah, she was a hell of a singer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
No, nobody could sing the national anthem like her.
Oh, my God. When I saw that, and you see her veins popping out, you know, it was real. I can't imagine that being overdubbed at all.
Yeah.
You know, it looked real. It sounded real.
Yep.
But a lot of people think she was just over, you know, singing, just pretending, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think so at all. That was such a great rendition of that.
I interviewed Dionne Warwick recently, and, you know, that was her cousin. They were cousins.
Right, that's right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I asked her about it. Was there any, you know, foul play, you think, done with, you know, that surrounded her death? Because there was, you know, a lot of rumors and this and that, whatever. She said it was her time, you know, when it's your time, it's your time. That's all she said about it.
Yeah. I know Clive Davis did a lot for her, a hell of a lot for her.
I know.
You know, he believed in her from the get-go.
Yep. Dennis, what do you got going on now? I know you want to promote get your email out there.
Let me know what it is. For anybody that's listening, you know, player, guitarist, whatever.
Right.
Writer. I was thinking this, you know, I was going to give my email out, which is producer Dennis Mackay at yahoo.com.
Okay.
producerdennismackay@yahoo.com. But if anybody's looking for arrangements, co-production, production, or critiquing a track, you know, or tracks, you know, or mixing or recording, to get in touch with me.
Okay.
Because I was semi-retired when I met Elijah Ford, and now I really want to get back into it. Totally.
Excellent. Excellent.
You know? But thank you, Ray, for allowing me to do that. That's great.
Well, of course. I mean, there, so many young artists could, you know, really value your work ethic, your opinion, your knowledge, you know? I mean, it would be wonderful for anybody.
That'd be great, because I've got, you know, I want to give back. After being in it for so long,
yeah.
I want to give back things that I, everything that I've learned and how I can help people.
Sure.
You know?
I got a question. You know, I got a new book out. It's called The Rock and Roll, The Rockstar Chronicles.
Right.
I've done countless interviews. If I want to do like a books on tape thing, could you engineer the, all those interviews together? They're all on, either MP3s or disc.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know, you want to get the best sound possible, you know?
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
yes,
good.
Definitely.
Excellent. I'll probably be contacting you for that.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Great. You know, and it's so nice, right, because I'm a fan of yours, too. You
I
know?
Appreciate
You've
that.
You've interviewed a lot of people, which is fantastic.
I appreciate
you know,
that.
Great questions. Just, you know, really exciting. You know, you're keeping it alive.
It's all for the love of music. It's definitely not for the money, because I don't make any money doing this.
I know. I mean, it's changed. Everything's changed.
It has.
In the old days, I was making a lot of money. Now, I work within budget.
I know.
You know, Dennis, I've only got this amount for the track.
Yeah.
I want to do it, but especially if I love it, too. You know, I like meeting the person, seeing if they're sincere, what they want out of it, you know, and just working with them.
Exactly.
You know, and working within budgets, that's what it's about, and getting your name out there.
Sure.
You know, for
sure.
People to go, I know Dennis McCartney. Wow, he did a great job on
exactly.
this. You know, hey, I'd like to call him up, you know.
Exactly. Networking, networking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dennis, thank you so much for being on the show, man. I really, really appreciate it. Let's keep in contact. We'll get you on the show again and, you know, get some updates, see what you're doing.
Great. I will do, Ray. I'll keep in touch with you. Now, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dennis. You take care, man.
And you. Bye-bye,
right.
Ray.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Special thanks to Trace Keane for arranging this interview with Dennis McKay. And, of course, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. And please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. And it's real news, people. And my new book is finally out, entitled The Rockstar Chronicles, Series 1, Truths, Confessions, and Wisdom from the Music Legends That Set Us Free, featuring over 45 intimate conversations with some of the greatest rock legends on the planet. Order yours today on hardcover or ebook at bookbaby.com or amazon.com. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans, we shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.